This episode of Landmine Radio is sponsored by Guido's Pizza. Located on International Airport Road in Anchorage, Guido's has been serving the best pizza, pasta, sandwiches, and more since 1984. Guido's is open daily for dine-in service from 11 a.m. to midnight, and they do takeout and delivery until 2 a.m. Whether I'm dining in a Guido's or ordering for delivery, the hardest part for me is always choosing what to get because they have so many amazing items on their menu. If you're looking for a quick bite or want to order food for a big party, Guido's is the place to go. Tell them Jeff from the Landmine sent you. Okay, back here in Juno studio office with my good buddy, Joe Geldof. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing well, thank you. It's nice to be here in the, these are impressive studio. You must be making a lot of money here.
It's a nice office, but not sure. It's a little, building's about 100 years old. Nice place, close to the Capitol.
Well, are there any rats here?
No rats. I believe there's some asbestos, though.
Well.
Up there in the roof, in the ceiling.
Just don't lick it. You know,
don't touch it.
Don't touch
it. No, I was in the other office that you recall down the hall. This one opened up, which is a little bit bigger, but also there's that little room back there. So I have some storage now. So I am moving on up, if you will, to the...
Good. It's nice. You know. It's nice to be here with you.
The best part about this building, it's called the Shattuck Building. It's an old building, but rents are very reasonable. It's not crazy expensive, but I can, from my door to the Capitol, is about a 45-second walk. Where other people, you know, are further down, you know, Wade to Goldstein, whatever, those, you know, it's a little bit of a longer walk. So if something's going on, if like something's happening in the Capitol and I got to get over there, sometimes things happen, right? They go like, bam, you got to get over there.
They do. And what is happening in the Capitol?
It's interesting. We're more than, you know, halfway through the 121 day. It's in the Constitution, it says 120, but I guess there was some ruling at some point. So maybe, you know, you're a lawyer, but there was a court ruling. It says day one doesn't count. So it's really 121 day.
Well, and that's only right. I mean, look at all the new legislators we've had. You know, some of them are still looking for the washroom, you know. But
well, the House had something like 19 new members. Two of them, Dan Sadler and Craig Johnson, had been there before, but 17 totally brand new, right? And then the Senate had some new ones too, not as many. But the Senate, it's interesting, like right now, last year was unique because it was a redistricting year, so there was 19 Senate seats up. This year, it's back to normal. There's only 10. And right now, all 10 of them have filed a run.
They like it down here.
Because it's four-year seat. Now the pays went up for everybody. They went to $84,000 this year. They did the weird pay commission, Soviet commission last year where they installed five new members.
But I
want to go back to the House, though. Like Laddie Shaw's not running. Ben Carpenter's running for the Senate. A lot of people, several of them are going to lose. Whereas the Senate's probably, I mean, some of those races are going to go a certain way. It's going to change a bit, but the House tends to have a little more turnover, you know, than the Senate.
Yeah. And I have to say, I go into the Capitol building occasionally. Sometimes I'm summoned. Sometimes I go up to see old friends.
Go testify on bills and it's very funny, very entertaining.
Well, I live to provide amusement. You know, you got to have a little levity, but I have to say, I like the new energy up there in the House. It's true. It's easy to make perhaps fun of folks saying they don't know where the washroom is. But, you know, we needed that infusion of new energy up there and new ideas and not just, oh, that'll never work. Because, well, why?
See, I think it's good to have some new people. You don't want to have the same people forever. But I used to be a long time ago when I was younger and kind of naive. I thought, fuck them, get rid of all of them, put in new people. But now what I've realized is when you have too many new people, right, you know, you lose some kind of institutional knowledge, you lose people that know what's going on. So the learning curve is so large. I mean, it's like I've been coming down here 6 years now with you know, Political Report and Landmine.
Mm-hmm.
And I've felt like I've just started to grasp, you know, really how things work here in 6 years.
Well, you're right. You point out something. You need a mixture of veterans and new energy. I mean, not every ice hockey team can be all rookies, but you don't want them all, you know, 39 years old mm-hmm. and over the hill.
Hey, I'm 39.
That's a great age.
So for the folks listening, you're a lawyer. People in the political world know you do a lot of big lawsuits, and you filed the lawsuit on the Walker trying to bond for the tax credits years ago. Other lawsuits, you've permanent fund dividend stuff. But I was just looking you up in the bar. You've been member of the Alaska Bar since 1981. That's before I was born, Joe.
Well, I tell you, Jeff, you don't look a day over 38.
I appreciate that. I mean, God, that's a compliment.
Yeah, I've been lawyering a long time. And I have to tell you this. I mean, I don't know how folks you want to get on this show, but I'm kind of an accidental lawyer. I always liked public law, public service. And, you know, I had no intention when I graduated from law school for being a lawyer, you know, going into court and filing motions and filing lawsuits and everything else.
Where did you go to law school?
I went to the University of New Hampshire.
Well, live free or die.
Well, I prefer to live free.
That's their motto.
You know, live free or let somebody else die. Wasn't that what George Patton said?
I think so.
You know, the whole point about being a lawyer is, you know, when you file a lawsuit, it means there's been a failure. And another old adage, you know, lawyers don't really win or lose cases, especially public interest cases. It's the public, or in some cases, the Constitution that gets kind of jammed. And, you know, at some point I realized, if you really care about public service and what's going on in this big, wonderful state we live in, you know, you got to do a little litigation.
Because on some of these public interest lawsuits, you can get some fees, but they're limited. I mean, you're not getting all your fees, right? There's kind of...
It depends. There's an aspect of a bounty hunter in here. But, you know, if you bring a constitutional public case, there is an incentive to keep track of your hours. Because if you prevail, the lawyers that work on it, and, you know, you always work with a team. On that case you mentioned before, the one, the oil and gas exploration tax credit, I worked with a woman, Sonia Kawasaki, who works in the legislature. Mm-hmm. A terrific gal.
Scott smart. Kawasaki's sister works for, now the majority, but for a long time worked for Senator Wilkowski.
True. And she would tell you she's Scott Kawasaki's smarter sister. He might have a different opinion, but she is a very fine lawyer. And she and I worked on that, and we put in a request for a few hours.
This is the... where they didn't pay the tax credits, the oil tax credits, and then there was an idea by Walker to bond or borrow to pay the credits, which got passed. But then you said, your plaintiff was Eric Four, is it?
Eric Four.
He said, wait a minute, there's some constitutional
language.
Let's
back up. Bill Walker gets tagged with being the blame. And, you know, Bill Walker wasn't a perfect guy, but that was what was his name? Sheldon Fisher. This was his genius idea that we were going to borrow big and pay back money that wasn't even a debt. And, you know, I don't know what he did. He tap danced his way.
Well, the credits were a debt, right? I mean, we owed them.
No, the credits were the credits. But that's not a debt. You know, this goes way back when we set up this program to incentivize oil and gas exploration, which is usually stupid if you start deviating from market-based incentives. So, you know, the politicians get together and said, well, let's offer a rebate, a credit on your taxes. Well, nobody took advantage of it because the only people who are really paying taxes around here are the production companies. So they made them transferable. And mm-hmm. the bigs, you know, what was it, the British Petroleum or BP or whatever we called them, you know, they didn't really need these cheesy little tax credits, but we had issued hundreds of millions of dollars. So the next step was when you
go back to the Cook Inlet before, those were different ones, but exploration credits, I mean, we're in the billions.
Right. Well, so we issued hundreds of millions of dollars in these tax credits, actually billions. And it still wasn't, and nobody was taking advantage of them, so they came up with this cash and carry thing. So you take the credits, which we've given to you, to look for, you know, hydrocarbons, and we'll buy them back. Well, all of a sudden, there was this incredible churning of people, including goofball outfits like Fury. Remember that? Fury came up here, and they were going to drill.
Oh, they're still around. I mean, they got bankrupt, and then now they're bought by this Hendricks guy, and they're still a player in the kitchen lights,
yeah,
you know.
Of course. You know, why leave Alaska when you can work the pigeons up here, you know? So they had this cash and carry, you know, cash for the credits, and we were buying back. And at some point, we got in a jam, and Bill Walker said, we can't afford to do that anymore. So that's where Sheldon Fisher came
up. Well, and weren't some of the credits, like some of these companies had you know, done some exploration or done some things, and either in the Cook Inlet or on the slope, and then they were owed, they were expecting, and there was a payment, but then obviously they were subject to the appropriation. And you know, there was an amount they were paying, but then it was like, well, we only have to actually pay this amount, which was, you know, much small, but they were expecting to get the, you know, and that's where the idea came from.
They were hooked. They were like junkies. You know, it was the big ka-ching is coming through. They're getting paid like a rigged slot machine. And then we ran out of money. So So they came up, Sheldon Fisher cooks up this lame brain idea that we'll borrow big and we'll pay back these things. Well, eventually, Justice Stowers, writing for the Alaska Supreme Court, said the whole scheme.
So he called it a scheme,
was unconstitutional.
This thing was approved. It was legislature approved. It was all.
Oh, yeah.
And then it whipped through.
It was hysterical. And Eric Ford, we're having a beer one night, and he says, have you followed this? And I said, yeah. He says, this is a bunch of bullshit. And I said, well, I couldn't agree with you more.
So
he
explain,
said, what are we going to do about it?
Explain why the Constitution says you can't do that.
Well, you can borrow money, according to Alaska's Constitution, but it's actually constrained. The people who put together Alaska's Constitution were not big on debt. And if you're going to borrow money, incur debt, you have to go out for a vote of the public, and the public's got to authorize that. Which is why I occasionally see these big Christmas tree bills. You know, we're going to build roads here, roads there, and everything. And everybody goes, well, yeah, I like that road. So I will authorize that, in a form of a bonded indebtedness. Or you can do a revenue bond. But there's got to be revenue coming in. And sometimes that gets a little goofy. But, you know, Alaska's Constitution is actually a very good instrument in terms of not incurring debt. And why do I say that? You look at all the other jurisdictions like New Jersey and New York, a lot of places, the politicians, when they don't have enough tax money to spend, they start borrowing money. Because most politicians, it's way more fun to spend money than it is to exercise, you know, prudent measures and say, no, we're not going to do that.
So went all the way to the Supreme Court, and then they said, yeah, we agree, you can't do this.
Right. And then oil prices went up, and the holders of this, of course.
They've mostly gotten paid off. I think
they paid them all off.
Already paid, yeah. They're mostly,
yeah,
last year was the last small payment.
Oil went up, you know, and then there was money there, and they have a lot more political leverage, these people. But it wasn't debt.
So earlier you said something about the market, and I generally agree with that. I mean, you want the market to do things. But, for example, in Cook Inlet, there's a market issue because, you know, there's people living, 400,000 people living in South Central. They need gas for heat. They need gas for electricity. There's Hillcorp, which came in, you know, bought some assets, and they're producing gas. They aren't really an exploration company. There's this Fury guy, Hendricks, who's sitting on a lot of gas, who we're not really sure. He's trying to get all these royalties reduced and property taxes reduced.
Most people in the political sphere think Hendricks is full of gas.
Well, yeah, he's a bad actor. But definitely, I mean, he got the whole thing on the cheap, on a fire sale. I think $15 million he paid. You know, it's valued at almost $100 million. The asset's $100
million. Good if you can
get it. They were owed credits, a lot of credits that they had outstanding. There's a dispute in Texas with another guy, Danny Davis from Escapeda, who's a working interest owner and also a overriding royalty owner. But he was working for Bill Walker before as an oil and gas consultant. There's a law about you have to wait a couple of years before you can go in the business
Jeff,
of the stuff you're...
Jeff, I mean, you're not going to invoke ethics.
You know what pisses me off in the state more than...
Are you going to bring up ethics?
You know what pisses me off in the state more than anything? And there's a lot of things that piss me off. It's so much shit happens that's visible, like Andy Baker, shadow lobbyist, who I caught a couple of years ago, literally lobbying money from the governor for this Voice of the Arctic, and they were taking money out of it. It was a slush fund, you know? You write about it, you Hendrick, whatever. There's all many examples. And then you, like, expose it, and nothing happens. I mean, we're supposed to have APOC. Their budget's been slashed. There's nobody really regulating or watching or holding these people accountable. I mean, you can pretty much do whatever you want.
Well, so...
And nobody really gets in trouble for
anything.
You ask
me, and I'm delighted to be on your show, but... Can I interview you? So, like, who is running Alaska?
That's a good question. That's a really, I mean, it's like a rudderless ship. Really. There's, we have no direction. No one's at the helm. We have no idea where we're going. You know, we're not building anything.
That's not true. I would bet if you had all 60 legislature, members of our legislature, and the governor, and all the governor's cabinet, and you said, we want to promote development in Alaska. They'd all go, amen. And if you said, we got to promote jobs.
Yeah, that's the most kind of bullshit, you know, overture talk, you know, soundbite.
Of course,
people can say those things. But like a governor always says for years, we're open for business. We're open for business. We're open for business. I had an LLC. I have some LLCs, some businesses. I wanted to change one. It's called a change of officials form. We have a guy we're bringing into my studio in Anchorage. No big deal. You fill the form, you change the ownership and $25, you know. I didn't mail it because I'm right here. The state office building's across the street. I went over there, gave them the form, gave them the check. And I said, when can I expect to have the website updated with the new ownership percentages? 4 weeks. I said, 4 weeks? I said, why would it take 4 weeks? I mean, that's like, seems like a pretty simple input, input something in a computer. Well, we're very short staffed. Some of these departments have 20, 30% vacancy rates. You know, we people are leaving the state for more than a decade, working age people. And it's like, we used to have a trade-off in the state where it was far and it's cold and it's dark, but there was high wage. I mean, you came 81, right? You were up here in the high wages, pensions,
79. Yeah.
You know, there was a lot going on. There was a trade-off. Now the wages aren't, I mean, the wages here compared to other states are not what they used to be. And there's no, and I'm not saying we should have generous tier one type pensions, but we should maybe have something to keep, you know, and those are all gone. So what's the result? People leave.
Well,
this open for business thing, it sounds great. Like you're talking about, you know, we want to attract business and we want to build things. I mean, those sound nice, but you can say those things and doing those things is different.
So how do you really build wealth? How do you really build a community? I mean, my Democratic friends are forever talking about community, community, community. And actually the community in Alaska in the last 40 years is frayed and is starting to tear significantly.
My
Republican friends, and by the way, I'm a Republican. Most people think I'm a rhino, but my Republican friends, you know, they always talk about creating wealth and everything else. But do we do either of those in Alaska? We spend a lot of money.
We spend a ton of money.
You know, and as a former senator and president of the Senate, Rick Halford once said, if you think the oil spill was bad, the revenue spill was even worse. And it was a puzzling statement. And I said, well, why do you say that? And he said, because when we were a poor state, every dollar mattered. And we were really rigorous in allocating money. If education was a priority, we paid attention to that. When the revenue spill happened, there was just this frenzy to spend, spend, spend. And we've gotten hooked on spending. And all the kind of qualitative analysis, the rigorous analysis, good decision-making, critical analysis that goes with spending has gone by the window, you know, out the window. And I think old Halford's onto something there. But we crossed that watershed mid-80s, well, I mean, '90s, and it's just a spending for. So here's my example. You know, a place like Singapore says, we want to be open for business. They don't have great natural resources. They don't have big rivers or anything. The people over there create wealth.
Well,
they
created an economic kind of hub. Yeah. You
know? Well, they created an economic hub. Out of what? Out of not a whole lot. You know, they don't have vast coal resources, oil resources. It turns out creating real wealth and sustaining real wealth is a brutally hard task. You know, our permanent fund corporation is not really up to it. Our legislature's not up to it. Our governor's not up to it.
The problem is this state has wealth. We have the permanent fund. We're rich in resources, oil, gas, coal, minerals. I mean, we should, and this is too late. I mean, we can hope maybe change it, but we can't go in the past. Alaska should be like Dubai. You know, of all the small population state, obviously we're a large geographical state, so there's some cost there. But, you know, since oil came in the 70s, right, the pipeline, all the money that's been, you know, squandered. I mean, we've saved some. We have the permanent fund. It's 70-some billion. But, I mean, that thing should realistically be double that or more. I mean, if that was $200 billion right now and we pull just 3% off of it, that'd be enough to fund the whole thing. Right now, it's 5% of less than 80, which a lot of people say 5% is too high. I mean, eventually you're going to...
By the way, for all your listeners of this podcast, all 17 of them or whatever.
A little more than that.
Okay. all 700. If you're not looking at Brad Keithley's weekly charts on the Alaska landmine, you're really missing something, because Brad Keithley, I don't always agree with him, but he's a clear-eyed, sober analyst of financial matters. And he gets it right way more often than wrong. And nobody listens to him. You know,
I've talked to Brad about this, but I think sometimes it might be you start to get too in the weeds on something. And, it, you know, if you're just a casual observer of something and you read
something that's so detailed,
it's hard to maybe kind of follow
it. Let's go in the weeds about the permanent fund. And leave aside the permanent fund dividend. Absolutely, without question, it was a smart thing to do to save some of the non-renewable.
100%, 100%, 100%. Yes, 100%, yes.
But speaking of 100%, in Norway, which probably gets the A or the A plus for managing a sovereign fund, they saved way more.
Well, their fund, I just actually looked, I was talking to somebody a couple of days ago, their fund's like 1.3 trillion.
Right. So the Norwegians, granted, they're a small, cohesive society, and they've been around for a while.
Well, they also pay income. They also tax themselves. Well, we don't do that.
Leave aside. But taking non-renewable one-time oil revenue from the North Sea and socking away 100% of it and then living on the interest is not just a genius move. It's like the only smart thing to do. Then the question becomes, what's your draw? 5%, whether you calculate it on 5% of the percentage of market
value. It's too much.
It's too high. Yeah. Why do I say that? Because all conservative economists and who are paying attention say, look, at the 100-year return on investment is probably around 4, maybe over 4, 4.16, something like that. Greg Erickson, doesn't matter. The Callahan guys that we pay, what, $435 million to manage the permanent fund, portion of the permanent fund, 5's too high. You go over to the capital, a lot of them think 5's too low.
Well, because they
want to spend more money.
A lot of them want to spend it, and they don't want to, and they don't want people to pay any tax. So it's nice to say, well, you know, you aren't going to pay an income tax. You're not going to have a sales tax, state sales tax, state income tax. We're going to, you know, also pay a dividend. Which I mean, it's interesting. The House just came out with their budget last week. Their second committee substitute. Now a lot of these people in the House were very critical, militant against Bill Walker for reducing the dividend, which I believe he was the right move. It hurt him politically, but that bandit needed to come off, and they attacked him and they went after him and they were just they just relentlessly went after Bill Walker. Ever since, that was 8 years ago, the legislature itself has paid a lower dividend. Now the Republicans are in charge of the House. Last year, the governor every year has put in this full dividend in the budget, hasn't gotten paid at all near that, except in 2022, and we can thank Putin for that, for invading Ukraine, and the price of oil skyrocketed in an election year. Total black swan event.
No. I disagree with that.
With what?
Going back to Brad Keithley, the smart way of projecting oil revenue is to go on a 10-year rolling average.
I definitely agree with that.
Everybody knows it, but they won't do it.
But after Russia invaded Ukraine, the price of oil went to over 100.
That's not a black swan event. Since I've lived in
a war in Europe is a black swan event. A war like an invasion. The last time that happened was in the 1940s.
But a precipitous 30s. Drop or a precipitous increase in oil, whether it's current prices or future prices, is not a black swan.
Well, no,
it
I mean,
happens
but
all the
well,
time.
But the last, I mean, it's not a, that, I was referring to the black swan event of this Russia invading Ukraine. But and the last time we saw prices
Russians
that high was.
The Russians invaded Hungary in the 50s.
That's what I'm
the
saying.
The Russians invaded Czechoslovakia in the 60s. So I was over
that's
in.
That's a long time ago.
I was in Spain when they invaded.
Yeah, that's
there.
A long time. It's a long time ago. I mean, yes, it happens, but I mean, nobody.
It happens every few decades.
Not in Europe.
Hungary in the 50s, Czechoslovakia in the 60s, you know.
Yeah, this is a long. What I'm saying is we haven't had any kind of situation like that in Europe. I mean, I guess you could talk about Bosnia in, you know, the 90s, but this was much smaller scale than what we're talking about. Anyways, but that resulted, if that wouldn't have happened, the dividend would not have been $3,200 in 2022. There's no way it would have been anywhere close to that.
Right.
But we had the money come in.
So if it was on a 10-year rolling average, you would have got a nice dividend, but not a whopper.
Yes.
And now you're getting these tiny ones and people who really need the dividend.
And I'm with you on the 10-year rolling. But the point is they were going after Bill Walker, the Republicans, and it was nonstop. Last year the Republicans in the House, the governor asked for a full dividend. They went down to the 50-50 amount because they realized we can't, you know, we have to get a three-quarter vote for the savings draw. The savings are kind of pretty low. This year, they just came out with their new budget last week. Now it's 30% of the POMV draw. So even the Republicans are starting to realize who run the House are saying, we can't afford this.
So here's the big political question that I hear from all you people who spend a lot of time in the Capitol. How is it that Governor Dunleavy, who, by the way, I'm okay with Governor Dunleavy's, most of his professed goals. You know, he's a smaller government guy. It's good by me. He's not huge on taxation. Good by me. So my question is, for what, 6 years now, Governor Dunleavy promises and never delivers.
Yeah.
On the dividend.
Well, it's not just a dividend. Where's the disconnect? There's a lot of other examples of things that he's talked about that he just either abandons
I don't want to trash the governor here, but how can a politician, he's overpromised and underdelivers. Why is he so popular?
Well, I mean, I don't know how popular he is. I haven't seen polls recently.
He won a re-election.
He won the re-election because
not even a runoff.
He had no conservative opposition. I mean, this Charlie Pierce guy was kind of a joke, and he had some sexual harassment stuff he was dealing with. I mean, he had no money.
Alleged.
But it was stuff going on there. He had no money, and then you had Bill Walker, who tried to make a comeback, but who couldn't really ever get any kind of vision in his campaign. Who was actually fighting Bill Lescara more than anybody. I mean, Dunleavy just kind of, I mean, I guess you can call it smart. He really didn't do anything. He didn't say much. He did the bare minimum, right? And he had a lot of money, and he was the incumbent. There wasn't, I mean, this kind of ranked choice thing. It's ironic how the Republicans are, many of them are so against the ranked choice voting, but with the ranked choice voting, they get a Republican governor reelected first time since Jay Hammond, first governor reelected since Tony Knowles, right? They get the House back. The Republicans take back the House. So it's funny to me how they're so adamant about ranked choice voting.
Well, there's a lot of
Republicans
passion.
Did pretty good under ranked choice
voting.
Would
you agree with me? In politics, in Alaska right now, contemporary, it's overwhelmed by passion.
There's a lot of that, a lot of
big,
emotion.
Big opinions.
But I want to go back to the governor. He came out, and this is where I really got frustrated with him. In 2021, there was a big press conference with it was like half the legislature. It was a lot of the PFD. I think Mike Schauer was there. Shelley Hughes was there. A bunch of, it was a huge press conference in his office. It was like, I don't know, 20 or 30 legislators were there. And he came out and basically talked about the 50-50, the half of the POMV, right? As a kind of a compromise.
Half of a too high.
Half of the draw. Which should
is
be,
too high.
The draw should be lower. I think most people agree with that. But in any case, That's a movement on the statutory issue dividend that has plagued us for 8 years. Okay, he comes out with that. Then the legislature puts together this working group, this bicameral bipartisan working group, fiscal working group. They spend.
Yeah, who's on that? Representative Carpenter,
Shelley Hughes, Lyman Hoffman, Calvin Shrug. It was a big mix.
Good bipartisan.
It was two people from each caucus.
And they worked hard.
And they worked for like almost a year. And they came up with a big report. And in the report, one of the recommendations was moved to a 50-50. Which is it's just still probably too high for the, but anyways, it's definitely a big step in the right direction of hey, we can't pay this full dividend anymore. Right? We're not going to pay that. Everybody was on the same page. The governor, sometimes like he's the guy who can lead on this issue, right? He's the guy. If anybody can lead on this issue, it's that guy. So he comes out with it. Working group comes out with their recommendations. Everybody's 50-50. Fast forward a year to March 2022, Russia invades Ukraine. Price of oil goes up. He has a press conference. In 1 minute, he undid 1 year of work by basically saying, well, we got to pay back extra dividend. Oh, we got to pay more because of the last year's. Anyways, he just kind of just totally got off that after a year of work, right, that everybody was on board with. And it was just poof, it went away. And then we got back to the, okay, now it's 30. Now big dividend again. Everybody starts to, well, I guess we can maybe pay big dividends again. Only because we had a multi-billion dollar windfall.
Is that where we got the energy rebate?
Yeah, that was, what was that? It was $3,200, and part of it was...
It's like $600 was an energy thing.
Yeah, part...
Which apparently wasn't taxable.
Well, that's what... And actually, Bert Stedman today was talking about they want to do another... Now the House... Here's another thing the House has done. There's a windfall, there's a waterfall in the current budget where if the revenues exceed, I think, $6.2 billion, then other... Of that extra money... Half supposed to go into the savings account, the CBR, and then half supposed to go into like a energy or extra dividend. Well, the House now is saying we have extra money. Well, fuck the deposit, fuck the savings. Even though we technically owe the CBR like $12 billion we've spent over the years, they said fuck that. We're just going to give it all out into the extra rebate dividend.
Well, you're making my point, I guess, that it's way more fun to spend money than it is to save money.
Well, especially in election years. I just got back. I was a month ago, not even a month ago. I was in Washington State. My friend Brian Fechter. Used to be Deputy Revenue Commissioner. He's working down there now for Governor Inslee's overseeing he works in the education budget, which, by the way, is like $30 billion. It's like 10 times larger than just their education budget. Right? I mean, they have a big, big budget in,
right.
in Washington. Anyways, they do something amazing that we should do here. They have an election. The year after the election, they put together a budget. Okay, it's a 2-year budget. In the second session during the election year, it's shorter. I think it's 60 days, and it's a supplemental budget. Right, so it's just way now. Obviously, they don't have to worry about the ups and downs of you know oil revenues going. I mean, they don't have those big shifts in their revenue, which we do. But I mean, wouldn't that be amazing if we just didn't have to every year fight like over this budget?
I got to tell you, Jeff, I am agnostic about that. The the Constitution is the Constitution. The legislative folks. Separate branch of government.
Go closer to the mic there, John.
They get to have their own rules, their own procedures. Now, you can second guess whether they're acting in a mature or adult fashion, but, you know, there's no silver bullet procedurally say, oh, we'll have a 2-year budget. It's like the education people are always saying, we need to forward fund education, just education, not roads, not...
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that forward funding thing. Nobody knows what that means. I mean, how much is it? The answer is always more. I mean, do we need to spend more on education? Yes, I believe we do. I mean, the energy costs have gone up, the insurance costs have gone up, but it's like what frustrates me with the education, whenever somebody brings up accountability or outcomes, you're like chastised. I mean, what's wrong with, we should all want better results and accountability in education, but like they bring that up and that's like you're like a bad person for saying that.
Well, but you're getting into the whole accountability. I'm guessing... When you were a younger guy, did you have chores?
Oh, yeah.
And were there consequences if you didn't cut the grass or whatever, take out the trash, whatever was on your parents' punch list?
Got yelled at, didn't get my allowance. Yeah, my dad was 25 years Navy, 2 tours in Vietnam, so I usually did what I was told.
Yeah. Well, you know, this goes back to Rick Halford's observation about, you know, the revenue spill was even worse than the oil spill because it shattered critical thinking about the ways and means of spending this money. It's just a frenzy. I mean, you should have seen it in the early 80s, before there was a crash. People would walk in, you know, I got a proposal to build something. And on the Senate finance, I remember, it didn't matter what it was. They were just, there was no backup. There was no white paper. It wasn't even on the back of a cocktail napkin. They just heard in the hall.
I mean,
they were funding it.
I've talked about this before, but I've heard stories in 2009 or whenever the price of oil went to 150. I mean, there was, you know, huge windfalls of, you know, millions of dollars extra per district. Hurry up, find the project, spend it.
Yeah. And so what does that do to the long-term health of our economy? What does that do to developing a solid cadre of people who will show up all the time, do their job?
Think about what the restraint, you know, 15 years ago when the price of oil skyrocketed. Think about what some restraint would have done. Even if they saved another $500 million, now 15 years later, we're talking about billions of dollars
right.
of compounding, right? That's available.
So let's talk about the things that are kind of off the budget. You know, not subject to appropriation, including everybody's favorite slush fund, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority.
Oh, God.
There's billions of dollars in there. And for what? It's basically a slush fund.
Well, every governor has used ADA for something. You know, it goes back a long time. And, you know, they point to like Red Dog, which was good.
The one bright,
but they have the one thing 40 years ago. And then there's like...
Which, by the way, didn't need... participation by Alaska Industrial Development and Export.
I mean, there's one, and I'm very critical of ADA, so I mean, there's no secret there, but there's one thing they've done recently that I'm actually optimistic for, and I'm usually not very optimistic about things in this day because I see what happens here and I get frustrated, but they put in $25 million, I think it's $25 million, to this Mark Begich property. It's a bunch of the people, but he's kind of leading it in Anchorage. It's a hotel. They're turning this old kind of rundown hotel into like a super high-end, hundreds of rooms. There's a restaurant. There's a conference. There's a brewing. I mean, it's. I think that's going to be a success. I really think that's going to be successful.
Well, I hope it is.
And it's going to be hundreds of jobs. So, you know, it's like if ADA is going to work, you need non-political people in there, smart people that just look at you have like Alaska Growth Capital. There's things that exist that like. That's what they do. They look at investments. They look at businesses. They look at, okay, what are we going to, is it worth to buy this business?
There's a role for an economic development organization. And especially if you're taking the last mile out of a project.
Yeah.
you're doing something to facilitate, but there has to be private sector buy-in. And there has to be, frankly, the thing that we're missing big up here, talented, skilled administrators who know what they're doing in terms of
project. Non-political. And the board's political. The director's always political. That Hearst just did a story about Rex Rock Jr., who was with the governor. He got kind of pushed out. And then John Mueller, who was working for the governor, special advisor, both of them, they got pushed out. Now they're getting these contracts with Ada, $200 an hour. We're talking about almost $200,000 a year.
Wait, are you telling me the staff, the executive director, they're steeped in solid critical thinking and that they're not? That they don't know about how the private sector really forms money?
You're fucking with me, Joe.
I am.
There's the Clark Kenny thing 4 years ago.
Ada is populated by political hacks who don't know what they're doing. And there's a reason for that. It's because it's a convenient tool for people who want to get their hands on public money without diligence and scrutiny.
Well,
and that's what's going on here.
It also lately has seemed to be the place where exiled people in the governor's office go.
Is that wrong?
Well, it's like, if somebody needs to work there, if you're going to have something like Ada exist, okay, people need to work there, but like you have Dave Steering went over there and Brandon Brzezinski went over there and Randy Rahr went over there. I'm not saying those are bad people, but it's like Ada is ultimately supposed to be an investment kind of organization who's supposed to look at projects and maybe they need a little extra money to get a project going. It's going to create jobs. It's going to be positive for them. Okay, I understand that. But there's so many fucking examples of this place. Just this Anwar stuff, this Ambler stuff, this lawsuit, all these like.
What about the West? West
I mean, just all these things. And some of those are good things. Some of those are good things. But
you're naming names here. I mean, Randy, he's the new executive director.
I like Randy. Randy's worked for a long time in the legislature.
He's a likable guy.
I'm not saying Randy's, but it's like, it's just, why is that place so fucking tainted with controversy or with like scandal? It's like every other fucking thing they do, it's like scandalous.
Jeff, I'll tell you, here's my observation, and it's one not with malice or anything, but as Bob Uecker once said about a baseball player, he's a 202 hitter, but it's a solid 202. Alaska is slowly receding economically, in part because we don't attract and retain qualified people who can have the critical skills.
We're not just not attracting, we're losing.
Well, sure,
people, working age people.
And they're getting run out because decisions are made based on, palism and buddyism and, their parents had a yard sign up there, so they got to get a job. And of course they think, well, that should be at least a range.
I go back to this Andy Baker situation with his Voice of the Arctic, not registered and lobbying illegally, no consequence, I pointed out. And then last summer, I think I got a tip that Andy Baker was, he's close to the governor. There was a meeting at Sullivan's Steakhouse in Anchorage with all these like mining executives. I heard about it. I went to Sullivan's. I had a meal. Andy Baker's there with the governor in this private room with all these mining executives.
Was that wrong?
I think he's lobbying. Yes. I think the public should know he should be registered as, hey, I'm lobbying for these mining. Anyways.
Jeff, I got to tell you, it's so much fun being on your show.
And then his son gets appointed to the fucking house by the governor.
Is that wrong?
I mean, I don't think it's a good look. I think it's just an example of what's fucking wrong in this state, where it's like who you know. And here's the other thing I noticed, I've observed, especially going down and spending a little bit of time in Washington. Washington's so big, the population's so big, the budget's so big. I'm not saying nobody has access to the governor there, but it's like, I think it's pretty hard, especially on a smaller thing, to get to the guy, Whereas here, it's so easy to get to anybody. And if you're a little bit of an influencer, if you have a little bit of money, you don't make some donations, you have some person some access somewhere. It's like so much of the shit happens behind the scenes, and it's to the detriment of this is why we're facing a lot of the problems we're facing.
But there's always a behind the scenes.
I just think it's worse here because it's a small state and people have so much more access.
Well, let me tell you, in the 70s, for example, or the 60s, when Bill Egan was around, I wasn't, but I caught part of Jay Hammonds and stuff. The degree to which they have integrity and a decision-making construct that says, I really hear you. It doesn't matter with you. See him down at the grocery store. I mean, used to be able to walk into the governor's office. There was no security. There's no gates. There was no glass doors here in the Capitol. You could walk in. Half the time, you'd go over to the governor's secretary, and he may or may not be in the office, and you'd make an appointment. I love that about old Alaska. With the money comes a lot of hustlers, you know, a lot of people who are clever. And it ultimately depends. Well, whoever we elect has to have integrity and the best interest of all of the citizens.
It's good to be able to get to these people. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. What I'm saying is when people with nefarious or kind of bad motives are able to get to them, and then you're right. It's one thing to get to them. It's another thing to have people stand up and say, I'm not doing that. That's stupid. Or like, you know, this is not something you should be coming to me with, you know, just because you gave me some money, doesn't mean I'm going to fucking do this for you or do that for you or, put your kid somewhere and give somebody a contract.
Well, I'm with you on that. But, you know, that older generation of Alaska, they were not perfect. I mean, Jay Hammond has kind of entered the halls of mythology as being like the greatest guy, the greatest, you know, governor ever in some people's minds. But what fundamentally made Jay Hammond, at least in my experience, good was he had some principles, and everybody talked about Jay Hammond's three-part test, which is it good for Alaska? Well, what does that mean? But, you know, you had to bat that around. Does it pay its own way? And then, according to everybody, there was a third part of the test, but nobody can ever remember what it was. But the fact is, Jay Hammond was a lot like Bill Egan, the old grocer from Valdez, you know. They would listen to everybody's story. You know, you'd get at least 30 seconds. But you didn't automatically get, yeah, I know that guy. Put him on the payroll. Or, yeah, send him a contract like the penny.
I was talking to a friend a couple days ago.
For the most part, Jay Hammond had his, there were sinecures and he had his favorites. You know, the staff was always, you know, what is Bob Palmer going to do now? You know, and next thing you know, you're building great terms. Nobody's perfect.
You're never going to totally eliminate that, but. I was talking to a friend a couple of days ago, a buddy of mine, he's lived here a long time. He's Russian and not involved in business guy, lives here in Juneau, not involved in politics at all, but through me kind of, you know, hears things sometimes and I tell him things and, you know, we talk more and more about it. And we were talking this weekend and it's like, I told him, you know, I'm not saying, you know, and there's so many more advantages in this country than Russia. We have a free press, you know, anybody like me can... You know,
hey,
like
you're born in the United States. You won the lottery.
Yeah, no, all those things are true. But what I was telling him is, you know, I don't think in many ways we're so much different than some of the corruption that happens in like the kind of Russian corruption we hear about, or Ukrainian corruption, or these Eastern some of these countries. We have similar type. It's a little more legal and it's a little more maybe overt, but it happens, right? And we're talking about it, and the difference is. From like a place like Russia or Ukraine or these countries where there's massive corruption is it happens here too. But for the most part, we look out for, if you're in this country, even if you're, you know, the poorest of the poor, you're going to get, you know, there's assistance for housing or for food. I mean, there's in other countries, there's a big gap, and that's why people are maybe so much more upset about it, because in those countries, there's so many people that are left behind and they see all these people doing these corrupt things and getting very, very, very rich. Whereas here, most people are generally, I mean, way better off than being in a country like Russia, being poor, you know, not having a lot of money in a country like Russia or Ukraine or some Eastern European where it's very corrupt.
Well, I don't want to sound too cynical, but, you know, the United States of America, where there was good opportunity for many people, not equal opportunity, but there was good opportunity, mm-hmm. You know, people who worked as opposed to dealing with finance, which is a form of work, or banking and stuff like that.
Well, they actually built things.
Yeah, they're being left behind in a lot of ways. And the elongation of the disparity between income is problematic in the United States.
Well,
the people who are working, you know, we're all pepped up, you know, when the Fed meets and, you know, they go around and, you know, our unemployment is really low. It's low in part because people just have stopped working.
Well, and it's also people who are working full time can't afford to have a good life. You know, I've always said, if you're willing to work 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week in this country, you know, doing whatever, you should be able to have a decent life, you know? And a lot of people are working two and three jobs just to just to have a decent life.
And those people should be rewarded. And people who are basically coming
what I was talking about earlier, we're definitely going in the wrong direction in a lot of ways. We're approaching like a Russian kind of kleptocracy where it's like the income gets concentrated on the top, and the people who are not the, you know, rulers or not the wealthy are working harder and harder, and they're doing worse and worse. You know,
let's bring it back to Alaska. What are the three things that you would do in Alaska right now if you were king for a day, queen for a day? If you had a magic wand,
I'd fucking fix the dividend thing. I'd find a way to get rid of the statutory thing and come up with it, whatever it's 25% or whatever it's. Maybe it's
you'd put it in the Constitution.
No, I wouldn't put it in the Constitution. But I would do something like
then it's not fixed.
Maybe it's like whatever we could, you know, this amount, and then, you know, if something really good happens, we can, you know. But I would get rid of the full statutory, and I would maybe do a 25%
In the Constitution.
No, I wouldn't do the Constitution.
Okay, Jeff, here's the thing:
enshrining that.
Not in the Constitution and it's not mandatory and enforceable, it's like taking your good friend who you really like into a bar and saying, who's an alcoholic, and saying, just have one. The politicians can't help it if there's not a bright line test on the dividend.
I think just at the bottom line, taking away the statutory dividend, putting in a statute saying, hey, whatever we can do, because that's basically what's happening anyways. So people don't even expect.
Well, that is what's happening.
You know, that's what's happening anyways.
So what do you think of Representative Carpenter's resolution to say, you have to follow whatever's in statute.
HJR 7?
Yes.
Yeah, it's been sitting in the fucking legislature for a month. It's literally been on the calendar every day for a month, and nothing's happened to it. So, I mean, that tells you a lot about where that's going.
The three-legged stool that makes up what we're talking about here, which includes taxes, cuts, and the dividend. Do you agree with me? That's metaphorically, that's the three-legged stool. You can't have dividend.
It's kind of a federal spending too, but it's part of the stool.
Well, I'm just talking about the dividend.
Oh, the dividend, yeah.
Dividend. You know, everybody wants a big dividend. Most people. But and everybody likes no taxes. None. We hard to pay any here. And nobody wants any cuts. You can't have all three things.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, it's like when you're designing an airplane. You know, I want a really fast airplane that'll go a long distance and it'll carry an incredible payroll. You can't have all three things.
Let me go back to your question. The second thing I would do is I would find a way to at least tell people this NIMBY bullshit's going to stop in this state, where every little thing, every small or big project gets stopped by a small group of people who are, you know, they got theirs or whatever. So I'd deal with the NIMBY problem, and I'd start building things. I'd start doing projects, infrastructure, bridges and roads and things. And then third thing is I'd want to have a gas line built.
Why do you want a gas line?
Because think about it. I mean, the what that'll do for 80% of the population, for energy, you know, for supply, for cost, all of these things.
Okay, so
you know, we're going to import the fucking gas anyways in probably five years.
If you have a magic wand, you have a gas line. If it's a free gas line, whether it's from the North Slope or however you...
Yeah, North Slope, yeah.
Okay. Assuming it's free, it's great. You'll have an...
Well, it's not going to be free, but we can...
You mean it's not going to be free?
If the state kicks in some money, you know, I was used to be kind of for the smaller one and just let's take care of ourselves.
The so-called bullet line?
Yeah, but it seems like probably the better way is to do the big one. And then I hate to say this because it's got kind of bad connotations, but they build it and they will come. If we get if we kick in enough money, the other producers or the money interest will help to build that thing.
So you want a subsidy?
Because
so you want a subsidy for everybody who's living on the hillside in Anchorage? You know, they built these big houses.
It's not just for Anchorage; it's for people. It's for anybody living in South Central, which is 80% of the population. And we should do something with the PCE, and we should make, and, you know, obviously Southeast has their kind of energy thing met. They have the hydro.
This is where I'm really a Republican, you know. Price for gas is the market price for gas.
But what is every other, like Saudi Arabia, even Russia, even Norway, all these places with vast resources, they find Tajikistan.
Venezuela, all the places where things go completely wrong.
I'm not talking about Venezuela. I'm talking about countries... Like, let's say Norway,
any place that's subsidized, Argentina.
It's where they have vast resources and they find a way to take those resources and meet the energy needs of their people.
Okay, so
what I was going back to cooking with the market, because the demand curve is flat, right? You could find a trillion cubic feet of spend a bunch of money, find all this extra. I mean, you're not gonna be able to get rid of it. You're not gonna be able to export it right now. So there's not really an incentive, market incentive, to go find a bunch of gas or produce a bunch of gas if the demand curve for the gas usage is flat. There's not some big windfall.
The world is awash in gas. It turns out the world is awash in oil. Getting the oil or the gas to where people are living and where they want to use it, actually, we've figured that out.
Okay, so we import.
What we haven't figured out is how to get it super cheap. I mean, everybody wants.
Okay, so we import gas from Canada or Mexico, LNG, and then we become essentially sitting ducks if there's ever any kind of war or war with China. All of a sudden, we're sitting ducks where those tankers become vulnerable to an attack.
Well, depends on where they're coming from.
Well, they're coming from Canada or Mexico. That's where they're coming from.
Well, if we can't defend on our side of the Pacific, so to speak, you know, a reasonable amount of shipping, then we're really in trouble.
Well, I'm talking about a fucking war, like a full out, if something happens in Taiwan and that thing spreads. I mean, I think we should take care of our, I think we should meet our own, take care of ourselves.
Well, where does that end though, Jeff?
I'm talking about energy. We have vast resources, oil,
I am
gas,
deeply,
coal.
Deeply suspicious of the politicians saying that we will somehow subsidize importation or the delivery of gas by building a pipeline.
Well, we're going to do it either way. If we import LNG, we're going to have to build a terminal. We're going to have to. I mean, either way, I'm talking about right now, even with these things in Cook, some way they're going to do some kind of subsidy on gas.
Yeah. So we're going to become like Argentina. Nigeria, Argentina.
I don't think we're going to become like.
Already are, Jeff. You got to look with a clear eye at what's going on here. The politicians are talking about they're meeting this demand, a political demand, for oh my God, we're running out of gas, and what the subtext is there? We want cheap gas right now, and you got to figure out how to do it.
Well, I think we need affordable. I mean, you need the gas affordable, but you also just need gas. Without gas. We can't heat our houses. We can't.
Well, whose job is that? Is it the politicians or is it NSTAR?
Well, it's the people that NSTAR doesn't produce gas. They don't produce gas. They buy gas.
Yeah. So let them buy gas.
So you think we should import LNG?
I would be very wary. I just think hundreds of billions of dollars because that's what it's going to cost.
It's not going to be hundreds of billions.
Jeff, the prices around here, they were talking about building a second channel crossing in Juneau, and it's already up to $400 million, you know, in a little peanut
they should,
place
they should, Juneau. They should do that, by the way. They should do it by the airport. I voted for that like 5 years ago. There was a survey. Opens up all kinds of land over there in Douglas.
You know, 85% of all the money that gets spent on these so-called development projects that we have to have, goes into consultants and engineers and DOT.
Well, they cut that shit out. But I mean, the answer is we just don't do anything. We just kind of we're fucked. We don't even build anything. We're going to import gas. Oh, people are going to leave. You know, it's too bad.
I love Alaska. I like living here. It's my home. I travel occasionally, but we have proven over the last four decades we don't have the skill or the will to get the right kind of people looking at in a clear-eyed way. At development proposals. You know, it's a collage or a kaleidoscope of, you know, bridges to nowhere, you know, fantasy projects across Kinnickarm, gas line here, gas line there.
Kinnickarm Bridge is a great thing. That would be a great thing.
Then they should build it.
They should.
It
they
doesn't
built,
pencil yeah, out, Jeff.
We spent, 2 years ago, we
Look
spent...
At Jeff, even the Alaska
ago,
Airlines Center doesn't
two,
pencil
two,
out.
2 years ago, we spent, the dividend cost about $2 billion. The bridge costs less than that. That's the bridge. Bam.
Then why didn't they do it?
Well, because they got to pay the dividend. It's an election year. This year, the dividend's probably, last year was almost a billion. It's probably going to be a billion.
Your point is the politicians, you and the politicians should get together and second guess. You are better at spending public funds on a specific project.
I think
project.
Public funds would be better spent on projects that benefit the public instead of just saying, well, we're going to, you know, give you as much money as we can, and please vote for us, and we're not going to tax you, and then by the way, we're losing population. We aren't kind of where we were 40 years ago. We're not doing things But hey, we got a check for you. So hey,
okay, so
we're great.
Magic wand.
Oh, the power grids, we're almost losing. We almost can't have enough gas delivered to meet power energy needs.
You're painting a picture here that's not very bright.
It's a real, I mean, it's a real picture. Everything it's, I said is
it's
true.
Very, very gloomy, Jeff.
It is. That's why we need to fucking do something about it.
Well,
I mean, it's like we all recognize it, but we just keep doing the same. What's the definition of insanity?
Yeah, that's that old canard about that.
You're getting me activated here, Joe. I'm getting blood pressure's going up.
Well, I'm optimistic. There's some of the new folks in the legislature and some of the old dogs. They're doing their job. You know, whether you like them or not, Senator Stedman and the group of people, they are engaged.
I like Senator Stedman a lot.
They have experience. And, you know, you can nitpick them on this policy or that policy, but, you know, generally they're adults. The House is developing a cadre of adults. I don't see so much in the executive branch. I don't see much attention paid to execution of government because they are the executive branch. They're supposed to be executing the laws of Alaska faithfully. Executing the laws.
Well, this guy Dunleavy's been there 6 years. He's got two more left, and he may very well be contending potentially with how the elections go. He could be dealing with a bipartisan House and Senate next, the last 2 years of his deal. So,
well, what do you make of this rumor that if Donald J. Trump becomes like Grover Cleveland and is reelected in a non-sequential way, do you think Governor Dunleavy will?
I 100% believe he's on the audition tour, the Trump tour for. That's why he's going to D.C. and that's why he's going to Texas and all these, you know, places where he's, you know, doing all this, a lot of his decisions he makes, a lot of his actions. I think he's auditioning for the Interior Secretary, potentially energy, but I think Interior Secretary, if Trump wins, take it to the bank, man. Dunleavy's going somewhere, probably Interior Secretary.
What will he do when he's the Secretary of the Interior? He's now Harold Ickes. Remember Harold Ickes?
It's a great question.
He was Roosevelt's Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've worked in the Department of Interior, the big palatial offices. It's imposing. It's big federal, you know, grand offices and everything. I actually worked with Bill Horn, who shows you how old I am.
I mean, I can't say
what's his agenda? I can't say what he's going to do,
but I'd say probably on the face would be beneficial for, I mean, with all the federal land we have and federal issues we have with the BLM and with the parks. I mean, probably would be a good thing for us.
Open up the country.
Well, I mean, there's
promote development.
We deal with so many federal problems, you know, with the BLM or the parks.
What problems? He's now the secretary. He's got Deb Haaland is long retired. She's back in New Mexico.
I'm sure there's going to be. I'm imagining there'd be more oil and gas development. More opening of public areas for, you know, recreation or for hunting, whatever. I mean, all these things. But
open up the country to the citizens.
Yeah.
Let it rip.
Let it roll, baby.
Chop the trees. Drill, baby, drill.
I said oil and gas. I said recreation. I said hunting. I didn't talk about cut down.
Well, I mean, trees is, Secretary of Agriculture for the most part.
Something else, you go back, Dunleavy gets caught in these ideas. Carbon. Carbon was like the future of the, you know, it's like, I don't even fucking hear shit about carbon anymore. I mean, there's some talk here and there, but, you know, this panacea of $1 billion. I mean, this is like, I mean, I think nobody paying any attention knows it's not going to be anywhere near that kind of money, but
so,
the thing's kind of just gone away. I mean, you hear about it a little bit.
I am not picking on Michael Dunleavy because I agree with many of the principles he's run on and espouses. But, you know, it's the execution and delivery. You know, like, you know, he is in charge of getting out the food stamps. And there's still a problem there. There's been a problem for years. You got hungry people out here. You know, and I'm not talking about whether the program has merit or anything. But, you know, we don't get the food stamps out, and it's always like, oh, we don't have enough staff. So what do we do with the commissioner? Well, he creates two departments, and then we put him in charge of revenue. How's that working out? I mean,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes somebody's got to get elected in Alaska who puts in probably fewer people that fool around with public decision-making with better skill sets and the potential to actually deliver on the promises.
Speaking of interior, I read this book by David Bernhardt, who was Trump's second interior secretary. And he wrote this book called You Report to Me. And it's basically about his experience. He was solicitor. He was under Bush and he worked there a long time. But he talks about how important it is for a president, or really even a governor. But I mean, on day, you got to start hitting the ground running from day one with very competent people who know how the system works, who can do things, right? Who can, because I mean, 4 years isn't that long. Even 8 years isn't that, you have to be on, hit the ground running. And there's so much that happens. I'm sure it's also in the state government, but in the federal, I mean, there's 2 million in the federal government, 2 million civil servants, 4,000 political appointees, right? Like, you really have to have people who know what they're fucking doing to make things happen.
It's a question of will. You have to have the will and the skill.
And yes, yeah, exactly. You have to have competent, good people that can do it, and not these political kind of friends of somebody or somebody's donors. They give you some money, so we're going to take, you know, the family, whatever. You know, so much of that, man.
We're so gloomy here, Jeff. I want to talk about some developments in the, if I may, on your show.
What do you got, Joe?
The most promising thing that I think coming down the pike is this term, within a couple months, the Supreme Court of the United States is going to rule on the case that, what is the name of it? It came out of a phishing case and putting on board observers. But what's in stake here is the so-called Chevron doctrine, the deference that the judiciary gives to the bureaucrats. And the bureaucrats anymore with the Code of Federal Regulations, they write the regulations and then they interpret the regulations. And in a lot of cases, they adjudicate the regulations. And I am not a big believer in the what some people call the deep state. But there is an administrative state, and it has mushroomed and grown in the last 100 years.
Well, Bernhardt's book talks a lot about the Civil Administrative Act and all these, the growth of the civil service over the decades. And how, I mean, it's basically, according to him, it's fucking basically impossible to fire somebody. You know, there's these kind of adjudicatory bodies that's not really legal. It's quasi, but you have like
administrative
judge, and it's not really, and it's just reading that book, you're just thinking like, it's like so frustrating.
So I view personally, in an optimistic way, the Supreme Court of the United States is going to overrule the so-called Chevron doctrine, this deferential standard to the bureaucrats that interpret, write, and adjudicate the laws. That's going to go away, and it'll cause big problems right away, because what's really happened is Congress has abdicated its lawmaking, and it's made the executive branch stronger. The Congress right now is not ready to pick up and resume their duties as passing laws, but they'll get there.
Well, that's what Bernhardt really talks about in that book, is we elect our representatives to represent us, and they're the ones supposed to be close to the people. You know, we don't elect these bureaucrats somewhere who nobody's ever heard of or seen, and they're doing all this stuff behind the scenes, right? And he argues ultimately it's up to the Congress should be, you know, overseeing all these things, like you're talking about.
The judiciary in the Supreme Court of the United States is going to, a lot of people are quite confident that Justice Gorsuch and a majority of the justices are going to pare back that kind of deference and ramp in or ramp back, I guess, the abdication by the Congress to the bureaucracy. I view that as very promising for the American Republic.
And yeah, no, that's
we're
a
not
good,
done
that,
yet.
That's a good. I mean, you should read this. I think you'd like this based on what you're talking. You know, this case is relevant to this book, but I thought it was a good read. It was quick, but it's just very eye opening for kind of.
We're not done yet, and we're not done in Alaska. We're in a rough patch right now because we're still digesting this massive oil.
This rough patch has been lasting for a long time.
Well, we didn't save enough, and we spent too much. We still spend too much. And we're not focused in on what we really need. But where else would you want to live? It's a magnificent place.
I love living here. I mean, I am as critical as I am, and there's a lot of things to be critical about. I love living here. I've been here 20 years. You know, I got my business here. My house is in Anchorage. My friends are here. I mean, this is a great place to be.
Wait, you have friends?
I got a few.
Good.
Maybe you're one of them. I got a meeting coming up here, Joe. But
thank you for having me on your show. It's
always
a delight.
Great talking to you. It's always a very energetic conversation, thought provoking.
Even though you swear, Jeff, geez.
Well, the FCC can't regulate me, buddy. Okay, this is not.
I know, but your dad, who served in the Navy, he would say, "Tone it down, big guy."
You should talk to him for 10 minutes, and you.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thanks again, Joe Geldof, attorney, Juneau resident, buddy of mine. So, folks, if you have an idea for a podcast or want to do a podcast, get a hold of me, and stay tuned for the next one. Landline.